Welcome to the Riverside Project podcast. We are mobilizing Houston to empower families and transform generations. We hope these conversations will give you a greater understanding of the issues facing our community and inspire you to find your place along the river. Hi, everyone. Today we have Chelsea Floro. Chelsea is a foster, adoptive, and biological mom to 8 children. She's been passionate about serving children in foster care and their families for the last 9 years, and she's the founder of the Moses Closet of the Woodlands. She's also the face behind the blog Real Life Foster Mom. Chelsea lives in the Woodlands, Texas, with her husband, Ryan. Chelsea, we're glad that you're here with us to just share a little bit.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
Of course. Well, again, I was mentioning this earlier. I have kind of followed your story a little bit. We're Facebook friends. I see posts from time to time, and your journey has just taken you in a lot of different directions. I've read posts and teared up. I have celebrated from afar. And so I'm really excited to just spend some time and kind of connect the dots that you don't get to kind of experience through Facebook.
Yeah.
Just tell me a little bit about, start off from the beginning. Tell me about yourself and how you guys got connected into the foster care world.
Okay. So my husband and I got married when I was 18, which is very young, right? So I was 15 when we started dating, 18 when we got married, and we decided we were going to start our family rather quickly because, you know, we were like, we just want to make sure we're retired by the time we're 40 and whatever. That's the goal. And at 20, I had my first child. And then at 22, I had my second child. And my son is, he has autism. And so some things happened and I could no longer have kids. And I thought, well, that's okay. You know, we've got a special needs child. We've got a boy and a girl. There's, you know, we're good. And maybe when I was about 24, I just really wanted another baby. And so at the time, all I could think about was adoption. And I was like, I just want to build on my family. I just want to expand my family. That was my mindset when we first started. So we had some friends that were adopting from foster care. And they're like, why don't you just, you know, check it out, look into it. And so we did. And my husband was like, absolutely not. We're good.
Often the case. Absolutely. For some reason.
And so I always say this, I begged and I cried and I tried to guilt him. You know, I'm like, look at these kids, you know. He's like, no, like, stop asking me. And so I took a year. I prayed. I just prayed to soften his heart. No. He did not want to do it. And one day he just said, hey, you know that foster care thing? Let's just go take the first class and let's see what happens. And so we did. And after that, he was like, let's go take the second class like tomorrow. And then he wanted to go. And so I was like, let's space it out. And he's like, no, let's get this done. So we ended up starting to foster, but it took quite a while. And I think that we were officially licensed when I was 25.
Okay. What made the switch for him? Just all of a sudden something switched?
Nothing. The Lord worked on his heart. That's all I can say, because there's no reason that it switched other than I stopped begging and nagging and pestering, and it was his decision, you know?
Yeah. What did you learn through just that, the licensing process? I mean, it's probably changed a lot even since then, but what do you remember, kind of what was your initial thoughts in that process and what'd you learn?
So honestly, when we went into the training, we looked at each other and we were like, oh, this is no big deal, because it's a lot of the stuff that you learn to take care of your children with autism. You don't, you know, you don't spank your children. It was a lot of the same thing. And we were like, oh, you know, this is no big deal. Actually, we're going to be the best foster parents. And you know how that is. The training prepares you for nothing. you know, it does, but it doesn't prepare you for the hands-on learning. Mm-hmm. You've got to do the hands-on. So I listened, I learned everything, but nothing compares to the hands-on.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about your first placement. What was that like?
So we had some kiddos, but I'm going to go into our first long-term placement.
Okay.
And so he came to us just a day after my daughter's birthday, and we got a call. I was working at the church at the time, and I got a call, and I was like, yes, this is we've been waiting. You know, this is our first real call. And we got a little boy a few hours later, and he walked in. He had this big mohawk, like up to here, and he was tiny. He was 2.5, but he was the size of like a 9-month-old. He walked in, and he had very little words, but he was like, "Mama," and I'm like, "Oh wow, that's you know, that's abnormal, right?
Yeah.
You know, and he was with us for a year and a half before he left to go be adopted.
Okay.
Which is a whole story.
Go ahead. If okay. you feel comfortable yeah, sharing so, it, I'd love to understand that a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, my goal was to adopt. I wanted to build my family, right? And when he had been with us for about a year, we started to just see just some really aggressive behaviors that we weren't sure how to handle. You know, we're new foster parents. We were trauma informed, but, you know, it's a learning. It's, I'm still
it
learning, and we're 9 years later. And we did a lot of therapy, and they just kept saying, you know, it would be good for him to be an only child. And I'm like, no, I've got two other kids. And we had another foster placement at the time, a little baby girl who's now my daughter. And I just kept fighting it and fighting it. Mm. One day, I went to a little foster parent meetup. And I saw some people. They had shared their story kind of, you know, that they couldn't have kids. They were looking to adopt. And every time they took an adoptive placement, things just fell apart and never happened. And I never even introduced myself to them, nothing. One day, I just really felt like, okay, I need this child to get what he needs. And mm-hmm. I don't think he's getting it in my house. So I just really felt like the Holy Spirit was like, reach out to this family. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So I messaged him. I'm like, I know you don't know me. You probably don't remember me. I was sitting across the table. I'm like, I really feel like you're my son's parents. And they write back, they're like, okay, well, you're crazy. And this doesn't work
such
like
an on-call.
This. I mean, it's so weird, right? And so this doesn't work like this. This is not how it happens. But I want to know more. And so we talked for a couple days, and then they did a little bit of respite. I think it was about 2 weeks later, he had moved in.
Wow.
And 6 months later, he was adopted.
How did the caseworker, did you just go to them and say, I think I found a home for him? How did
I did, and
how
it
does
was
that
crazy.
Work?
It was crazy because the caseworker thought we were going to adopt him.
Okay. Or at least that you wanted to.
That we
right.
were going to.
Yeah.
Or that we were wanting to. And he was heading towards that. That was the goal. And so she thought she was just under the assumption, you know, that we were going to move forward. And when I came, I think it was shocking. It was, are you sure? Everybody, you know, are you sure? Are you sure? Are you sure? I'm like, I'm not, but I feel led that this is the right decision. And now I know that if we would have adopted him, I don't think we could have continued because I think we would have needed to focus a lot of our time on him. And I don't think that we could have continued. So now I look back and I see, okay, that was the plan. That was God's hand right there. So no, the caseworker kind of laughed at me, but
it worked.
Yeah, he's been there. I think he's been adopted now for about 8 years.
Okay. Yeah.
What was and I still see him.
Oh, you do? You get to still have
still
a relationship
to see him.
With him?
I just went to his birthday party in October.
Okay, he's doing good.
Yeah.
What was the grief? Like, was there grief involved in that? I mean, it seems like you had one, at least an expectation of one thing, and then it kind of shifted, and you're like, I don't know if this is the right decision or not,
yes.
and we're just going to move forward with it.
Yeah.
What was that part?
So we dropped him off at their house on July 4th, and I got in the car, and I hyperventilated and changed my mind and said, no, that's... like, he needs to come back, but it was done, you know? I mm-hmm. went home. I think I cried for days. I think it was more guilt. Did I just do the wrong thing?
Did we give up on him?
Yeah, what is he thinking right now? Is he,
right.
is this going to ruin, you know, his life? All of that was me and not him, you know? And so it took me a long time to kind of grieve that I had made that choice and that I had put him in that position.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I felt like
sure.
at the time.
You don't know the bigger picture
yes,
at that point.
And I couldn't see anything past me giving up on him.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously now I look at it and I'm like, oh my gosh, he's thriving. He's still an only child. It's been the best mm-hmm. decision for him.
That's good. What happened after that? What were the kind of subsequent placements like and how did your family grow? Tell me that.
Okay, so we had Savannah already in her home and about a month
after. How old are your kids at this point?
I feel like Troy was 7 and Avery was 6, something
okay.
around there.
So school age-ish.
Yeah, school age. And so we already had Savannah at that time and that was a mess. We intervened in her case because just CPS, there was no parents involved. So it wasn't like we were fighting parents. We were just fighting. They wanted to give us PMC and we weren't, mm-hmm. you know, we weren't able to do that. So, about a month later, we went to court with our lawyer and we were just there to do a normal court date. And the judge just said, I'm tired of this. We're doing the adoption today. So my adoption paperwork for her is like handwritten. She wasn't even at her adoption. So, and after she was adopted, we were just done. The system had, you know, it's broken and it runs you over, and we just could not imagine doing anymore. And we got our one, you know, we said one perfect baby, you know, that was the plan, and we were done. We decided to close our home. But 2 weeks later, I got a call from our agency and saying, hey, we have these twins. Now, I know you're not open, but we found a family for them. And they're out of town for a little bit, and they're working on finishing their license. Is there any way you can foster them until, you know, they get back into town and they can finish up? I'm like, absolutely. So my husband was going to be on a week-long trip, and I thought, he's not going to care. He's going to be gone. And it was only supposed to be for that time period. Well, my husband's trip got canceled, and he walked through the door, and I've got Savannah, who's 9 months old, and
like,
I've got these twins that are like 6 weeks old on the floor, and he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, it's only a week. It's only a week. And they were then adopted maybe 5 or 6 years ago by some of our friends who they weren't our friends at the time, but they've become our friends. And so I also get to follow their journey. They were with me for such a short time, and you know, they were placed with me for such a short time, but I still get to watch their journey. It's really cool.
Yeah, that is awesome.
So that was for sure it. We were done. And then someone who ran a nonprofit, and I think she was like the board of the child welfare for Montgomery County, she kept posting about a little baby boy who needed out of the NICU, and he was disabled. He was missing parts of his legs. They believed he had fetal alcohol syndrome, and they needed an adoptive home. They mm-hmm. found people to foster him, but they said, we want someone who's willing to adopt because this is going to adoption. And so, you know, I looked at my husband, and he's like, no.
So we had a plan.
He's like,
we had a plan.
Yeah, absolutely not. And he's like, and also, why do you think that we can take this on, right? And so a nurse who also happened to be at CASA called me. She's like, let's just talk about it, because she had adopted children from China who had disabilities. And she's like, let's just talk about it. You know, you have a son with autism. You kind of already know the medical world. This is not like, not having legs is no issue. And I'm like, are you sure? You know, whatever. So she
seems like a big issue.
It did at the time. And so a few days later, Charlie came home, and he was this tiny little baby. He was born at 4 pounds, but I think when they brought him home, he was like 5.5 pounds. He's missing both of his femur bones, both of his hips. So his knees are where his hips should be, and then his feet. And so at the time, you know, they told us he'll never walk. We don't really know. It's called bilateral PFFD, and there's only, you know, like 100 people in the world at that time recorded with what exactly he had. And so we're like, all right, let's just, you know, take this step by step. Ended up adopting him.
Your husband's like, I'm just going to throw in the towel.
I know. But right before we adopted him, we took a placement of a 7-year-old that she was with us for about 20 months. She ended up leaving, and she was adopted by a kinship placement. So we're like,
it's a lot going on.
Sure, we're done, right? We've adopted two. We've sent some kids, you know, back. They've been adopted. And then we did respite. Someone said, hey, we need respite. They got this 15-year-old, and I'm like, I can handle a 15-year-old. And so this girl comes to my house for a week, and I remember it was Shark Week. I don't even remember what week it was, but it was Shark Week. And she came, and we watched Shark Week all week. She was just so quiet, so sweet, no problems. And then the next day, the foster mom calls me and says, hey, she like enjoyed your house, and she really wants to be adopted. She's 15. She's going to age out of the system. We're not adopting her. Would you consider it? And I wrote back, no, we're done, and we're not ready for teenagers. I want to say at the time I was either 28 or 29. I'm just too young. This is not going to work out for me. She said, no problem, no pressure. Thank you so much for doing respite for us. The next day, my husband and I were like, man, we just really feel convicted. So I text her back. I'm like, I actually want to talk to the CPS worker. I think that we want to get a little more information. And I didn't hear for weeks. And I thought, okay, she was mad at me for saying no in the beginning, whatever. So then I finally reached out to the caseworker. I'm like, hey, I text anyways. Found out that the foster mom had broken her phone, so she never got my text. The caseworker came over, sat down, had a discussion. You know, we went through the whole process. We did a RAS. They picked us. We had to read her file. It took months and months and months. She finally moves in, I think, right after her 16th birthday or right before her 16th birthday. She ended up choosing not to be adopted, because she had been previously adopted. It didn't work out, and she chose not to be adopted.
Yeah.
And that was a new experience because we, you know, we had shifted our mindset to, we are no longer looking for a child to fulfill our family. We want to be a family to a child that needs us, right? And so we were like, wow, this is new. This family does not want us, or this child does not want our family. So we weren't really sure how to process that, but she still lived with us until she was 18.
Was it more like she didn't want you as a family, or she just didn't want the adoption on paper?
She didn't want the adoption. Okay. And she did a lot of self-sabotage, acting out. And it was really hard. I'm not going to lie. It was actually extremely hard. And when I dropped her off, she went to go live in a home for girls to kind of teach them how to, when she was 18, to get into the real world. And when I dropped her off, I really didn't know if I'd ever see her again, right? And so the next day I text her, I said, hey, can I bring you a cup of coffee? And she said, sure, we can't go inside because you're not background checked, but we can sit in the car. And she said, I just realized that, you know, y'all are my mom and dad, and like, dad will be the one that walks me down the aisle one day. And I'm like, wow, you know, just because she didn't want to be adopted, just because there's no paper, that doesn't mean she's not my child. And so she's 21 now. She's about to make me a chichi, which means grandma. I'm 35 years old. I can't be called a grandma yet. So she is doing great. She's living on her own in an apartment with her boyfriend, and she's really thriving. That 15 to 18 year old that I knew, that's not the same person that is today. She has grown and she has done so many great things. And again, just because there's no paper, that doesn't mean she's not part of my family. I mean, yeah. I just talked to her right before I got here. So
sometimes it's kind of like the bending towards what her needs are in that moment, right? Rather than our expectations.
Yes.
Like you kind of had gotten there to us on your turn, like in a certain way, but then shifted even further to what her needs and her desires were, versus the expectations that maybe we had at the beginning. Goodness,
it was a wild ride. But it was my first experience with any teenager besides myself. You know, I know what teenage girls are like to some point, but add in the massive amounts of trauma, the 20 placements before us, et cetera, et cetera. But then during that time, before she left, we got another call. I have to tell you that this is just so bizarre because my husband had gone to the hospital and we think he had COVID. It was right before COVID was actually a thing. And he was in the hospital. They were about to vent him. Like it got pretty, they couldn't figure out what it was. And I got a call and they're like, we have this little 6-month-old baby boy. I'm like, oh man. My husband's about to be vented. I'm like, what do I do?
It's like the worst possible
time. I know.
Time.
Isn't that crazy? And I was like, well.
The fact that you,
I'm like, just bring
him. Just bring him. Hang up the phone.
I know. I was like, yes, bring him. And so they drove 2 hours. He's from 2 hours away. They drove him, dropped him off, and I packed him up, put him on my chest, walked into the hospital to see my husband. And I said, hey, here's your new son. My husband's like, hi. So we have that kind of back and forth where he says, you know, as long as it's within our parameters and you say yes, it's fine with me. And so
he's come a long way.
He's come a long
way. Oh, my goodness.
I'm telling you, look what the Lord does to people's hearts. And so Maisie was with us for 20 months. And it was such a weird thing. He had a 16-year-old mom who was living on her own. We offered for her to move in with us, and she didn't want to. She did not want to enter foster care. We talked every day. We text. It was during COVID, so he didn't really get to see her in person. They kept telling us, you know, we want to reunify, but it's probably not going to happen. Mm-hmm. All the other aunts, family members, no one can pass a background check, or they're young, 19, 18, you know, whatever. They can't take care of him. And so we were told, we just supported reunification. I thought, I want this girl I'll keep him until she's 18. I want her to have her baby. I love her. Like, I still love her. We just talked a couple days ago. So I was like, sorry. I get really emotional talking about him because I just love him so much. But they told us that we would get to adopt him. After a while, they said, you know, we're going to termination. We're not giving any more extensions. We're going to move him to adoption. So termination happens. And I just assume we are going to the adoption unit like in a couple weeks. And I get a call from CASA the next day and he's kind of tearing up and he says, Chelsea, I have to tell you something. And I was actually in the hospital with my other kiddo at the time. And he says, an aunt stepped forward. And it's the same aunt that said no so many times. But we really think that we should send him because mom just needs a few more years. And family loves him. And they just needed this 20 months to get their stuff together to be able to care for him. So we're going to send him. So I went from one day saying, okay, I'm going to have this open adoption. This is going to be beautiful, to they're going to take my son. And so what happened is I thought they were going to move him soon, but it took 6 more months for them to get everything done for the home study and completed. So for 6 months, it was crushing. We knew. We just kept waiting. Okay, are they going to take him tomorrow? When is he going to go?
Yeah.
And when he finally did go, they called us and someone we didn't know. And they said, hey, tomorrow we want you to, or they said, tomorrow we're going to come pick him up from the house and drive him the 2 hours. I said, no. I want the aunt to meet us halfway so that we can do the handoff because I think it would be traumatic. They all agreed. And we get to Bucky's. We drove all the way to Bucky's, about an hour away. We get there. A caseworker shows up we've never met. And I'm like, no, where's the aunt? And she says, oh, she can't make it. And I was like, so we're just giving you him? And she said, yeah. So he had never met her. He gets in her car. He's screaming and crying. We are all crying. He was 2 and a half at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been with us since he was 6 months old. And so it was so emotional. We actually had someone stop and they said, are you guys okay? And we're like, you know, we are okay, but we're...
It's a long story.
It's devastating. Yeah, I know. It's devastating. And the CPS looked at us and said, why are y'all so upset? How long have y'all even had him? And we said, you know, 20 months. And she said, I had no clue. I just thought you were short-term placement. And so that right there wraps up the foster care system there's not a lot of...
The communication.
Communication. Not a lot of people know what's really going on, like the trauma that probably caused him. We did get to see him a couple months later. That was the last time about 3 years ago that I saw him. But I do talk to them. And his 5th birthday is coming up. And they said that they're going to send us an invitation. So we'll see. I would love to see him again. I'm really excited. But I see pictures of him. He looks beautiful and healthy and perfect. Yeah. And so, again, this is exactly what was supposed to happen. So it wasn't on my timeline. It wasn't my choice. Mm-hmm. But what happened was supposed to happen.
And I love that there's kind of this, I'm going to cut you off there, just... I think the hands being open, like the wide open, even if my expectations, this is not working in my timing, this is not working in the way that I expected, but being able to be open enough to say that was really, really, really hard and yet it was still right.
Yes.
I think that's a hard thing to wrap your mind around and wrap your heart around. And I know that it wasn't perfect. No one does anything like that perfectly and there's grieving involved in it. But I think that there's just something really, really beautiful in holding those two things in tandem. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. And I think the best blessing that happens in foster care is you only see the next step. Mm-hmm. You can't see the full picture. Because I don't think any of us would continue if we saw the full picture. So I see one step and I'm like, I can face that step. And then when the next step comes, I'll take that challenge.
Yeah.
So we are going through all this stuff with Maisie and at the... same time we had a little baby, he came to us. We drove 9 hours to go pick him up. We had to spend the night in the hospital. We show up to the hospital. We were told, okay, he has a little health issues, nothing major. So we go pick him up and I look down. I'm like, what's that in his face? They're like, oh, that's oxygen. And I was like, oh, okay, you're going to take that off. And they're like, no, he has to come home with it. And I'm like, okay, we can learn that. That's fine. So then we get on a call with all the doctors and there's like 20 specialists. No one told us. No one told our agency. And our agency called us and said, turn around, go home. This isn't what, you know, we didn't realize this. We were told it was a basic child. We didn't know. So you can go home. And I said, I've already fell in love with this baby. He's in my arms. I'm sitting in his hospital bed. You know, whether or not he stays here, I'm going to take him home. And so that was a wild ride. We ended up taking an ambulance ride all the way back to Houston. And we got home and the oxygen concentrator was there. And I was like, is anybody going to tell me how to hook them up? And the ambulance people are like, no one taught you? And I'm like, no, I don't know. No one taught me. So the ambulance, the EMT were amazing. They were like, we can't plug it in for you, but we can kind of tell you what to do. And so they kind of taught me. And then I had other people kind of jump in from our neighborhood or friends who fostered medically fragile children, you know, come over and teach me how to do certain things. 6 weeks later, I'll tell you, for those 6 weeks, between the time he was placed with us and Christmas Day, I watched that child die in my arms so many times. I had friends over and he would just lay limp, and we didn't know if he was going to make it. We didn't know what was wrong. He was in the doctor. He would just lay limp in the doctor's office, and they would call people in, crash car. I did not know. It was nothing I was expecting, because special needs having no legs is a lot different than special needs medical attention. Mm-hmm. And Christmas Eve, he stopped breathing. And well, it was like 11:59, and we called the ambulance. They showed up at like 12:07, and it ended up that he had a CO2 of like 115 or over. Like, it maxed out at 115, so we don't know, which is like a death sentence. So they started him on all of this stuff. They ended up realizing that he has no swallow. He was aspirating every single thing that he was drinking. So they had to put a feeding tube in. And then we stayed in the hospital for 90 days straight. I did 72. My husband did the rest. And we forfeited our family. You know, like one person was with the other kids at home. One person was at the hospital all the time. We didn't want to leave him at home by himself. They told us he needed a tracheostomy, and we were like, we can't do that. So they ended up sending him home on a test, like to see if he could go home on a high flow oxygen. We get home, we do great for about a year. He still needs it. They said, I think he's going to need it for the rest of his life. He's attached to all these machines. He can't walk. He can't do many things because he has 2 feet to move. We need to do the trach. Okay, so we have a little bit of medical under our belt now. We feel comfortable. We have nursing staff. And so in July of 2022, June of 2022, we went ahead and did a tracheostomy. And so then we not only went from just a
full-blown nurse at this point.
Yeah, I'm a full-blown. I think about it. I'm going to go to nursing. If I had time, I'd go to nursing school because I feel like this has just prepared me for that. Mm-hmm. But so now my miracle baby, he has since been adopted. He did stay with us for about 2.5 years before adoption occurred, but he is walking. He is trying to talk through his trach a little bit. He just started school last week. He's so cute. He's 3.5 right now, and he really is a miracle child. Like, they did not – he was a twin, and his twin passed away. They were both micro preemies. He was born at 1 pound, 13 ounce, and the fact that he made it and he lived – like, your life has a purpose. Mm-hmm. You're this miracle baby. And we just keep seeing him do all these things that they say he won't do. And now he is severely disabled. He's always going to be disabled. But he is perfect. Like, he is just exactly the way he's supposed to be right now.
Yeah.
So then that brings me to Gina. Gina came for respite as well. She was 17. I got a call like at 9 o'clock at night saying, I have a 17-year-old. She needs to come spend a couple nights at your house. Is that okay? We don't have anywhere for her to go. I said, okay. So like 4 or 5 days later, I'm like, okay, no one's going to pick her up. Like, what's happening? The family had discharged her, and CPS.
So she really didn't have
a place to go. And we're like, okay. And that was also my husband's birthday the day she came. So she got to go to the birthday with us. He's like, happy birthday to me. Like, you are so lucky this whole time. But so she came, and they discharged her, and CPS said, hey, I've got nowhere for her to go. So she can either stay with you, or we can put her in a group home or a shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, of course not. She's going to stay with us. And it was January when she was 17. And in August, like the first week of August, we went to an adoption. She was going to age out, and August 27th mm-hmm. was her 18th birthday. And we went to an adoption of a boy who was 17. One of my friends adopted him. And she just broke down. And in the car, she's like, that's my dream. I'm going to age out, and I've always wanted to be adopted. It's never worked for me. She'd been in care since she was a baby. It's not going to happen for me. And so I'm talking, this is August 5th, maybe. I get on the phone with CPS. I'm like, how can we do this before August 27th? Because she wants it. And, you know, we're her family. So from August 5th to August 22nd, we got an adoption done with everything in foster care, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
It's unheard of. So we asked her if she wanted to be adopted on the 10th. She said yes. And 12 days later, we did a Zoom adoption. They were still doing Zoom in her court.
Yeah.
And she's 19 now.
But that means the world to her that you fought for it, you know, fought for her to get that.
Yes. And I had a lot of people, her CASA, her caseworker, the lawyer, everybody, everything had to go perfectly for it to happen in that amount of time. And they did it. And the judge was like, we're making this happen no matter what, because this child deserves a home. So now she's 19. She is living on her own. She's doing really good right now. And again, I talk to her every day. We're very close. She is my daughter. And then once we adopted Ricky, which was May of last year, a few weeks before, a friend that I had met in passing reached out, and she's like, hey, do you know anybody that would want to adopt a special needs little girl? She's 6 months old. There's no family, but we're not interested in adopting her because they just wanted to continue to foster. Their heart is fostering. And I'm like, well, let me ask my husband. And so we did respite for a little bit. We adopted Ricky, and then we put our name in for her. She had a broadcast. We put our name in for her. We were like, you know what? If they choose us, they do. And if they don't, they don't. And the CASA said, we do not want someone with more than two kids in their house. We had five at the time in the house. Okay, you know what? It's not meant for us. Then we got told that we were picked. Out of all the families that put in their name, we were picked. And the reason we were picked is because they came to our house and they met Ricky and they heard his story. And they said, that's what we want for her. Because she was supposed to get a feeding tube. They're not sure. She's missing one third of her brain. So they're not sure if she'll ever talk or if she'll ever walk or do XYZ. And so she has been in our house. I think she was placed in June, and we should be, the redacted file is missing. But once it's found, we should be adopting. We thought it would be this month, maybe next month. We'll see. But so she will be our final and our last adoption. We will have six under 18, and that is Texas. And I'm very thankful for that because I probably would just keep going. But this to me is like, I'm solidified. Like, this is done.
Yeah. Gosh, looking back at all of those experiences, they're all different. They all challenged you in different ways and your family in different ways. Are there any key things that you can kind of pull out as things that you have learned? I would assume if you look back to your 18-year-old self getting married to the person that you have kind of become through these experiences and the children who have impacted your life in this way, what would you say you've learned from it?
So much. I think the most important thing I've learned is it's not about me, and it can't be. It cannot be about us. It has to be about the child. It has to be about the children. And if you are doing this for any selfish intent, like I did start with, it's going to be really hard. It took me a little while to realize that that was very selfish. How I came into it and the reasons I came into it. I think what else is really important that I've learned is that trauma isn't just something that happens to you. It's something that lives with you. It physically affects your brain. And I think that I wish I would have really understood that before I started foster care, because even the infants that come to you, their brains have been formed in stress, sometimes with drugs or abuse, and they need to be parented differently. And so I wish I did take trauma parenting classes, but I don't feel like I fully grasped that.
Well, it's hard, I think, because at the beginning, you don't have the context, you know? And
exactly.
So I have felt the same way. I'm like, I wish I was more prepared at the beginning.
Yeah.
But the thing that you lack is the experience, and the experience is what really is what teaches you along the way. And so I think it's more so like the being willing to be teachable all the way through.
Yes, yes.
But yes, I agree. Yeah. Absolutely.
And then another strong key that I've learned is that things are going to go the way that they should go. There's not going to be a child that's left out of your family. They're not going to be a child that's not supposed to be there. The way things are, the way they're going to go. And I wish I would have learned that faster than last year. No, I feel like it took me so long to understand and not have this horrible anxiety every time we go to court, or they're going to take this child away from me and it's going to be distressing, or
the what ifs kind of.
They're going to terminate on this mom and it's going to be horrible and I think he needs to go home. None of that matters. what is going to happen is going to happen. And you just have to be able to say, you know what, use me. I'm going to go through this. And whatever happens, whoever is in my family in the end, that's the way it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one thing I wish I would have told myself. I've spent so many years with anxiety and stress and some depression along the way because I couldn't control what was happening.
Yeah.
And that would be, if I could go back and tell my 25-year-old self who just got her license and is like holding it up like, hey, taking a selfie, that's what I would tell.
Yeah. And in this space, and especially in foster care, but really just parenting in general or just life in general, is a lot of anxiety does come from wanting to control and trying to surrender the need to know what's coming and the need to be able to protect ourselves. I think there's a lot of joy to be had. I speak very much to myself in that. There's a lot of joy to be had in letting go of that.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about just the challenges that you've seen, challenges, but also the joys of seeing kids move from who they are when they come to you or who they are, when they first enter the system. And then with support and care and a lot of struggle along the way, who they can become.
Yeah.
How have you seen moments of transformation?
Yeah. I'm going to use a specific story. I had a kiddo come to me. I'm not going to use a name, but they were an older child. And they just wanted to do everything they could to get kicked out of our house. They had been in so many homes before us, just one after the other, after the other. And she actually lit a fire in our house, in her room. And we put the fire out. They were like, do you want to discharge her? We're like, no, no. And she came to me after that. And this is after months of just sabotage. She said, why didn't you kick me out? I said, because that's not what family does. You know, we don't kick each other out because we do stupid things. I do stupid things all the time. I hope no one kicks me out of my house. And she just started crying. And I think that was the first time she realized, like, she said, everybody kicks me out. Like, this doesn't make sense. And I see that when you go through these challenges and you stick by them, yeah, I easily could have said bye. Like, this is not safe. This is not okay. Which at the time, it went around in my head, like, should we not do this? This is kind of scary. But if you stick it out, you're going to see an amazing transformation. You're going to see these kids who went from living in total chaos to they're growing. They're able to get off of their high psychotropic medications because they're learning to deal with their anxiety. They're learning to communicate and have attachments.
Mm-hmm.
So with my older kiddos, that's one way. With my kiddos that are disabled, you know, it's a lot of learning, you know, learning this, learning that. But a lot of times they're telling us, oh, okay, well, this can't happen and this can't happen. And so just from the love, my one son, he has a heart defect. And one day it just disappeared and it was great. And they were like, okay, we don't need to see you for 3 years. And my Charlie, who he was probably like 5 at the time, he said, we loved him so much that his heart isn't broken anymore. And I thought, what a perfect thing. Because yes, we are loving these kids, whether they're disabled, they're not supposed to walk, they're not supposed to talk, but we're loving them, we're giving them everything, and just love
mm-hmm.
grows and helps heal these children. And so, I mean, they're still, like I say, they're still disabled, but the joy in doing those hard things throughout the way, learning, I never wanted to change mm-hmm. a trach in my life, that does not sound appealing to me, but learning to do that, and learning to do it through love is helping mm-hmm. Ricky
yeah.
heal.
It's coming toward them where they are.
Yeah.
You know, and being willing. Our friend, you know, Jason Johnson, in some of our church leader trainings, will often say it's saying we're gonna come to you and stay there, make a home there, and help you to know that we're not going anywhere. The healing effect of that, and what that speaks to a kid's
yeah.
life is transformative. It truly is. You spoke a little bit about just the system in general, and we're very acquainted with some of the flaws in communication, and it's very much a large and complex bureaucratic system with many different players. There's CPS, there's agencies, there's court systems, there's education specialists and things like that. What do you feel like is most needed? If there is a couple of things that you would point to, just from your journey that you wish you could see improved, what would you say that those would be?
Well, I think the system as a whole, if I can be blunt, is not set up for anybody. Caseworkers are overworked. Foster parents are, there's no communication. They're, you know, run through the mud. Biological families are trying to keep up, trying to work, do everything. I think the system is just, it's designed to protect our children, but it's not always doing that. It's not always in their best interest. And so collaboratively, we need to come together to make it about the child. But I think what we need to see more and what we have been seeing more is the community coming to step in. Mm-hmm. And we have great volunteers like CASA. I think most of my cases, I don't know what I would have done without the volunteer, mm-hmm. the CASA volunteer that came to my house every month. I mean, that's probably the one that I text first, like, hey, this needs to get done. I'm going to tell CPS, but I'm telling you so it gets done. So I think the community to step in is what's needed the most, because over the last 3 years since we've had Ricky in our home, I have just seen people in the community out of the woodwork come and help our family. But I don't just want that for me. That mm-hmm. needs to be for every family. Yep. And I'm involved in a church and I have a great church family, and they delivered meals for 30 days straight while we were in the hospital with Ricky getting the tracheostomy. They hired cleaning ladies. They delivered groceries every week, you know, whatever. They gave toys to my kids so that they wouldn't be sad that their mom was at the hospital. You know, that community, but not everybody needs right. it. So I am so blessed to have been able to build that over the years. But something needs to happen right when you first start. The turnover rate is so high, and it's what, like, most people don't make it over a year or mm-hmm. pass their first placement. And so what would happen if there was some sort of community that just right away, hey, what do you need? Maybe I can just pray for you. Maybe I can go pick up the medicine at the pharmacy for you. What do you need? I think that would make things more successful for mm-hmm. the kids and the foster parents.
And I think that there's people willing. There are Houstonians 100%. Willing. It's just sometimes making those connections, whether it's through churches, whether it's through community organizations, but saying, hey, there is a place for you to do something. And it may not be, you know, fostering a kid. It may not be, for some people, it might be becoming a CASA advocate, being able to volunteer their time to come alongside someone in that case and get trained. But there's so many different ways that somebody can step in. And I think sometimes we just don't know how, and we just don't know where to start. And so that's a lot of kind of the work that we're doing, but also a lot of the work that many community partners and churches are starting to move towards. And I've definitely seen some improvement toward that over the last couple of years.
I definitely have. It's very appreciated from the community.
Yeah. Well, as we start to close out our time, I typically do, we already shared so much of your story, but I wanted to share or ask a couple of kind of quick five last questions that are just a little bit more rapid fire. I want to know, how did you and your husband meet? You were so young, so I assume it's maybe high school or something.
We actually met. He was my sister's best friend, and I was in fifth grade, and he used to call me Shrek. I was big and very tall. I'm 5'9", and I was been 5'9 since I was like in fifth grade, and I was taller than him and big, and him and my sister used to say, oh, there's Shrek. You know, that's Shrek. And he would say, I'm going to marry Shrek one day, as a joke to my sister to kind of gross her out. Then I went to high school, and I became Princess Fiona is what he says. And we met again when I was in high school. And
did you go to the same high school or different high schools?
We did. We did different times.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah.
So, and then we got married when I turned 18.
Okay. Very cool. What was your favorite childhood TV show?
Saved by the Bell.
Okay. What was your favorite character?
Gosh, Kelly.
Very good one. Who inspires you?
So I thought about this one, and I feel like this one's really hard, but the people that inspire me are the people that keep me going. And so there's a lot. There's just too many for me to mm-hmm. name one. And so I just feel like it's all the people who keep, when I'm like, I'm done, I can't do this anymore, they're the ones that are like, no, what do you need? You want a coffee? Like, is that what you need? Do you need a Snickers bar? We got you. Do you need prayer? All of those people are the ones who are inspiring me.
Yeah, it's good. So needed. Mountains or beach?
Beach.
Okay. I feel like most people, especially this time of year, would probably answer the question that way. And lastly, we talked about trauma-informed care. What's your go-to resource if families are out there kind of wondering where to start or looking for a resource?
What would you say? TBRI, Karen Purvis is always a go-to. Mike Berry, Honestly Adoption. I've taken a lot of his classes as well, and I can really appreciate their perspective. And they've already adopted, and their kids are older. So I really appreciate that as well.
Yeah. One question that I wanted to ask, so I'm going to circle back to at the very end, just to close us out. If there's someone starting on the journey at the point where you were, you know, when you and your husband just first started the licensing process and they're about to take their first placement, is there any one piece of advice that you would give them?
Love that child like they deserve. Love them. Don't guard your heart. Don't hold back. You're going to get hurt eventually, whether, you know, it's going to happen, but love them, because that's how we heal and that's how we get on, you know, even if they go home, you filled that gap for this child. So fill the gap, love them. Don't be afraid.
Yeah, it's good. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. I'm really, really appreciative that you stepped in. I'm appreciative, and many of the kids in your home are appreciative. I know that you kept going. Thank you for encouraging us today, and for encouraging the people that are listening.
Thank you.
To those listening, we hope these conversations have inspired you to find your place along the river. And we welcome you to join us in bringing hope and renewal to the city of Houston. If you'd like more information on how to get involved, please visit riversideproject.org and submit a contact form. We'll see you next time.